22-2073 Montoya v. Goldstein. And Mr. Jaffa, you're up.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am David Jaffa. With me at counsel table is Evan House, who ably assisted with the brief. And we are here today in this bankruptcy matter. And I want to go all the way back to 1912, the opinion written by then Associate Justice Hughes for the Supreme Court, where we get the antecedent for the defense that was presented in this matter, the earmarking doctrine. And in that case, which is the National Bank of Newport case, cited in our reply brief, it's also cited by Judge Thuma in his opinion, finding the defenses for my clients, who are, I neglected to say that, Paula Goldstein, Robert Bobby Goldstein, her son, and Bobby Goldstein Production Incorporated, so BGPI. So I am, with your permission, going to address each of these individuals by their first names or BGPI.
Do we have an earmarking doctrine in the Tenth Circuit yet?
We have it. It certainly exists in the sense, and so we'll just start right there, Your Honor. Looking at Judge Briscoe, the most recent case, as the court is aware, is the matter of Wegenegg, okay, which was a Tenth Circuit case from 3 years ago. And in that matter, we had a loan by mom of Mr. Wegenegg to pay attorney's fees to the Stevens and Little Law Firm. Mm-hmm. In her dissent, Judge Briscoe outlines the three rationales for maintaining the earmarking doctrine, which we have, as began already in 1912, as I said. But we have it here when you have, as in this case, co-debtor. You have a third party making a loan to the debtor. And I know Your Honors know the facts of the case, but it may be helpful if I'm going to stop, I'm going to interrupt myself and say what we have here is we had a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, where we had a plan that was confirmed. The payments were to be to Class 6 and Class 7 creditors. Class 6 creditors had to be paid first. Class 7 creditors were then to be paid last. There was a 48-month payment plan by Chusa Oil, the debtor. Co-debtors in this case, and that's important to know, are Bobby Goldstein and BGPI. Bobby Goldstein was the CEO of Chusa. His father, the late Leon Goldstein, loaned $500,000 to the company on a note, and the note was then remade. That was in, I believe, 2014. In 2016, the company declared bankruptcy. The plan was confirmed. The Chapter 11 plan was confirmed, guaranteed by the co-debtors.
As a result of the payment to Paula, did Bobby and Bobby Productions, did they become Class 6 creditors rather than Class 7 creditors? In other words, do the Class 6 creditors lose out because of the payment from the interest in that there's fewer dollars to pay their claims and that there's a competitor?
I'm sorry. It's a good question because one might think that but for the earmarking, Bobby and BGPI would become Class 6 creditors, but Bobby is also an insider to Chusa, and he's a guarantor on the note. So, and one of the purposes of the earmarking doctrine, as Your Honor is aware, especially from the oral argument in the Wegenegg case lays this out pretty well, as does the majority opinion, that the idea then is a debtor, someone like Bobby and BGPI, should not have to pay twice. So do they become Class 6 creditors? Not necessarily, because they're simply credit. They're guarantors anyway.
So we don't know the answer?
We don't know the answer, and I'm going to submit it does not matter. Why? Because here, where the uncontroverted, plausible testimony of Bobby Goldstein is, I intended to make a loan, and then so I need to go back to the factual recitation in order to first answer Judge Tukovich's question about do we have earmarking. When there was the second Chapter 7 bankruptcy, involuntary bankruptcy of Chusa, Bobby then lent a second tranche of money to Sousa in order, why? To pay all the creditors, in order to meet the plan that was ordered from the Chapter 11, the original bankruptcy. He did that as a third party. Now, trustee wants to say, well, it's the same guy. Not really. And this is centuries of entity law.
Yeah, I hate to interrupt here, but is the answer to Judge Phillips' question that Bobby Productions, as the new lender that paid off Paula, why don't we know if it's going to become a Class 6 creditor here?
Because they were not made part of the bankruptcy. They were not made part of the bankruptcy in that sense, so that there's three ways they do not.
Well, let me ask, are they on equal footing after the Paula payoff? Are they on equal footing with the other unsecured creditors?
I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. I don't believe they are.
Well, the BAP concluded that it was on equal footing and therefore diluted the claim on the estate of the other unsecured creditors, right?
Correct, and that number one is an incorrect conclusion, and I'll explain why.
I think you just said we don't know.
Well, so I have to backtrack, okay, and I apologize. But if Bobby was a guarantor, and BGPR were guarantors, they're co-debtors. So whatever they put in, whether they're going to get back last in any event, but now, if I could answer Your Honor's question this way. There are three ways where we don't, are they new Class 6 creditors? And the answer is no. I'm going to say affirmatively no. I apologize for the confusion, but I don't think that's unusual because part of the...
You're going to say that they are not Class 6 creditors? Bobby and BGPA? You're going to say they are insiders who have subordinated debt?
I'm sorry.
I infer from that that you're making a pretty significant concession that Bobby and BGPI, if I understand what you're saying, are, in your view, Class 7 creditors, which would put them on a subordinated position along with Paula. Or did I misunderstand?
I misstated, and perhaps I've misunderstood the question.
I may have misunderstood.
No. Okay. I'm going to try and answer this way, Your Honor. I apologize for the confusion and the frustration. I want to answer first. I'm going to do this in this order. The BAP opinion, first of all, is persuasive, but I'm going to say they got it wrong. They are not, even if they're Class 6 creditors, which they may well be, they don't take in the same fashion. Why? There's three reasons why. Because the subordinated debt is paid by the third party, and that's Bobby and BGPI. Okay, so the new creditor money is Bobby's money. It's not the debtor's money. It's not Chooses' money.
But Chooses is going to have to repay Bobby if they are Class 6 creditors. So if he pays $8,000 or BGPI pays $8,000, $5,000, you gave the example in your reply brief, I think, that in the one-year preference period that there was a $15,000 payment to Chooses that would be repaid to Paula, and that there was a $3,000 excess that would be payable to the other Class 6 creditors. The anomaly is if Chooses is going to have to repay Bobby not $15,000 but $18,000, and so there's a mathematical inquiry that nobody really ever answered, and that is, for purposes of diminution in the estate, would the existing Class 6 creditors be in a better position or a worse position because they have $3,000 more, but now they have to pay not only the $3,000 but the $15,000 repayable to Bobby and BGPI?
Okay, I appreciate Your Honor's explanation. It gets me to this answer. No distinction. Why? Because the money is not Chooses. That's the whole point.
Well,
the money that Bobby...
Chooses didn't control it, but Bobby could have just paid Paula, and he didn't. He ran it through Chooses. And accordingly, Chooses became obligated to a debt for Bobby for the payment to Paula. All his choice. and consequences follow choices. Once he dumped it into Chusa and used it for accounting purposes, he said, which I'm still not sure I understand what that means, certain things happen. He could have just paid Paula. He didn't.
Well, he didn't owe Paula. I mean, as a guarantor, you're saying, Your Honor, that he should have just paid her directly.
Well,
that's what happened in WagonNet.
I'm sorry?
That's what happened in WagonNet. Mom paid the law firm directly.
Well, the difference is that Bobby was a pre-existing co-debtor. That is the very important distinction. Mrs. WagonNet was not a pre-existing co-debtor to her son. Here, Bobby is and was a co-debtor, and that's why it's important. But
was there any advantage to Bobby to run this payment to Paula through the Chusa? Yeah.
Well, because Chusa needed the money. That's why we're at the earmarking doctrine, because it was conditioned. Chusa had to pay creditors under the original Chapter 11 plan, right? Having that obligation, had Bobby not loaned that second tranche of money to Chusa, no one would have been paid.
Are you talking about the $400,000, or are you talking about the interest payment to Paula? Was the interest payment to Paula required to be paid under the plan?
Yes.
By that amount and that schedule?
I don't know the exact amount, but yes, that was part of the note that she held.
I understand there's a debt, but I thought you were tying it into the plan.
Well, the plan, that's why I guess the trustee sued for the avoidance. But here's the problem with that, is when for the plan to be paid, the Chapter 11 plan to be paid, before the Chapter 7 gets filed by the trust, or by the involuntary Chapter 7, Bobby has to loan the money in order to make the payments on the plan. As a condition of that loan, he agreed to pay Paula the interest payments only, which amounts to about $46,000. That was a condition that he paid, that he made, and he testified to that. That I can tell you straight away is in the record 063
by the contract between them.
And so that was a condition of that second tranche, roughly $400,000. But without that, none of the creditors would have been paid because Chusa was out of money to make the plan payments. So it was a condition, and that's what makes it earmarked. That's how it's earmarking, and that is the case law up to point, including the dissent. That's why I say if we look at the three points that Judge Briscoe lays out in her dissent that disallow the avoidance, right? The trustee can't seek an avoidance when what? You have a transfer from the lender to the creditor that didn't constitute a transfer of the debtor's property, and that's the case here. It was not debtor's property. There's no diminution of the debtor's estate.
Well, that's the whole question, and that's why we're asking about Class 6 and Class 7 to try to get an answer on that, to determine that question.
Okay, but Bobby is a co-debtor, right? And so I understand the question, but it's not necessary to answer it because Bobby, as an individual, is a co-debtor, right? So he doesn't, even if he becomes a Class 6 creditor, the distinction between him and other Class 6 creditors falls away. If he's a Class 7 creditor, that distinction also falls away. Why?
Well, because the point is that had it remained Paula's debt, or Paula as the creditor, the Chusa may never have had to pay her because it never got to Class 7, but it is going to have to pay Bobby if he's a Class 6. And therefore, this estate is diminished. Right or wrong, that's the argument. That's why I care.
Okay, fair enough. But the estate can't be diminished based on the case law. Even if Bobby becomes a creditor, which if he's a third party, right, that gives money, loans money, gives money, puts money in the bankruptcy estate, it's our position. And that was the position of the bankruptcy court, which is what I'm defending here, not the BAP. I'm not arguing against the BAP per se. is that that's not money of the estate in any event. So it doesn't make a difference. So the distinction does fall away. It does not make a difference.
Even if we agree that it's not money of the estate, the way this transaction is structured, the way this transaction is structured, it dilutes the claim on the estate of existing creditors. And that's what I understand the BAP to have concluded. And I still don't feel that I've gotten a clear answer that why that's right or wrong. I mean, it seems to me that there is a dilution unless somehow this deal made the estate whole and took care of, that put existing creditors in the same equal footing they were before the transaction.
Well, I see my time is up.
Go ahead and answer my question.
Okay. So if the money does not become the estate's money, okay, because it is a third-party payment by a co-debtor, then there is no diminution of the rights of any of the other creditors. And the preference is allowed because, if we're going to call it a preference, which we do, that is allowed because the whole idea was, but for that money, no one would have been paid. Zero payments.
Yeah, okay. What if, Bobby, you put the earmarked funds into CHUSA, and then CHUSA failed to pay off Paula? Could Paula have sued CHUSA for the earmarked funds?
Well, the restrictions may, the stay notwithstanding, she would have a right because of the agreement. Absolutely. And she certainly would have a right against Bobby as a co-debtor, as a guarantor.
And then that basically would be a liability against the debtor's estate, right? Her claim in the lawsuit.
I don't know if she, it might have been, except that, again, I don't know that she, it's Bobby to whom she would have to first look, because he's the guarantor. That's the whole idea of a co-debtor and a guarantor. So I understand, again, the Mobius flip of this, if you will.
It just seems to me if she didn't get paid by CHUSA, her claim would be thrown in the pot with all the other creditors. And, she would have taken a haircut just like any other creditor.
Except we have 111 years of law that says in a particular case like this, where a loan by a third party is made in order to protect the creditors, where there is an earmark, that earmark gets to be paid without diminution of the estate.
Okay, so your answer to my question is she would get 100 cents on the dollar based on the earmarked funds.
She gets her interest. I don't know that she's not going to get her $500,000 back.
She's going to get the 46.
I'm sorry. She'll get 100% of the 46,000 on the interest, because that was the deal she made. And the law in this circuit allows for that, as well as other circuits.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Let's hear from trustee, Mr. White.
Thank you, judges. Dan White, Askew, and White for appellee trustee Philip Montoya. I'm going to start by addressing some of the questions you asked during the initial presentation. The first one being, does the earmarking doctrine exist in this circuit? My answer to that question is no. The Bankruptcy Code replaced the Bankruptcy Act in 1978. The Bankruptcy Act was an 1898 law. The Bankruptcy Code of 1978 was a complete overhaul of the bankruptcy.
How do you distinguish the 1912 Supreme Court opinion?
I'm sorry?
How do you distinguish the 1912 Supreme Court opinion?
The 1912 Supreme Court opinion was an opinion under the Bankruptcy Act of 1978. We didn't have the modern preference statute, and so it was talking about law under a statute that no longer applies and hasn't been in effect for 50 years. So I just think it's law about a statute that's not currently in effect, and it doesn't make a difference. So I think, when we talk about modern case law referring to the earmarking doctrine, it's true that Marshall uses the word extend when referring to the earmarking doctrine. And appellant has taken that to mean that the earmarking doctrine must exist. But if you look at the actual cases, Marshall is using that relating to Moses. And in Moses, it's saying, well, we don't know whether it exists or not, but it definitely doesn't apply here because it's a replacement of an unsecured debt with a secured debt. So I don't read Moses to say that the earmarking doctrine exists. I read Moses to say the earmarking doctrine, whether it exists or not, doesn't apply to claims under 547, which is half of the case we're here on, and doesn't apply to cases where an unsecured debt, which is replaced by a secured debt, analogous to the replacement of the unsubordinated debt, or sorry, the subordinated debt with subordinated debt in this case. So even if the earmarking doctrine exists, it definitely doesn't apply in this case if you follow Moses. So I think that question can be fairly clearly answered. The second question, did BGPI and Bobby move to a class six claim? That is a little bit complicated. The answer is no, but. So the first question is no. The second question is, was the estate diminished? The answer is yes.
Well, wait a minute. And maybe you're going to answer this, but if Bobby and BGPI are class seven creditors, their debt is subordinated, just like Paula's. So I don't understand how you can possibly say that the estate is diminished if the existing unsecured creditors will no longer have to compete against Bobby or BGPI for this, for example, the $18,000 that was contributed to the CHUSA within the one-year preference period.
That's what I'm about to explain.
Thanks.
They
Sorry.
Are not classified creditors, period, of any kind.
I'm eager. Sorry.
Because classified creditors are classified under a bankruptcy plan. The new debt that Mr. Goldstein and BGPI created by transferring money into CHUSA after its Chapter 11 plan was confirmed is not classified debt of any type because it did not exist when the bankruptcy plan was confirmed.
Okay, can I ask you a different question?
Yes.
Now that you fully answered that question. So I have a question about this diminution in the estate. What is the test? For example, it seems to be a fairly philosophical, esoteric question. If what you just said, that makes sense. So in the one-year preference period, Bobby and BGPI contribute $18,000. CHUSA repays $15,000 toward this $46,000 interest payment of Paula's. Now, then the question is, there's two questions. Was the debtor's estate inflated? Well, if everybody agrees that it's inflated, your argument, the BAP's argument is, well, now, however, existing unsecured creditors will have diminished rights because now they're going to be needing to compete against these new unsecured creditors. And that's, nobody answers that mathematical question. And I don't know that you actually can because everybody's going to vary. Some unsecured creditor might have a $1,000 claim, and that creditor might have, be fully repaid 100% on the dollar with or without Bobby or BGPI's additional claim to the repayment of the $18,000. Another large bank might have a $200,000 debt, and they may not. Now they may be hurt by having to compete against Bobby and BGPI. So do we determine diminution in the estate based on what it sounds like? Was the estate inflated? Did it have more money than it otherwise would have? And the answer to that is clearly, it seems to me that your adversary is correct. There's more money in the debtor's estate. Why do we consider on a creditor by creditor basis whether he or she is going to be in a better or worse position now that they have to compete against Bobby and BGPI?
Okay, that's where I was going. I'm going to answer that in two parts.
Sorry.
First, I want to talk about the Whiting Pools case. That's the Supreme Court case where the Supreme Court tells us that a repossessed vehicle that a debtor has no control over is still property of a debtor sufficient to be property under 541. So we're looking at what was transferred. We know that even a repossessed car, which the debtor has no control over,
right,
could be sufficient.
I'm crediting your argument about control.
Right. Okay. Right. So, well, see, I don't know that a debtor has any control over a repossessed car in the hands of a creditor. So if my bank takes my car and I can't drive it anywhere, I can't do anything with it, I don't have the title, I can't sign it over, I don't know that I have dominion or control over that vehicle. So I'm using Whiting Pools as an example because a car is a little bit easier to conceptualize. So a car in the hands of my creditor already in the hands of my bank, I can't do anything with it. All I have is my bare legal title. That's it.
All right.
That is property of the estate under 541, according to the Supreme Court. And since we know that I don't control that vehicle because I can't do anything with it, I can't even transfer it to anybody. We know that a loss of that vehicle, if a creditor sells that to somebody, must be a diminution of the estate. And so we know by reading Marshall in light of the White and Pools case that my loss of bare legal title is enough for diminution of the estate. Now, what you're getting at is, well, what actually happens? Do creditors lose money? How much do they lose? Well, you can never answer the question.
That is not my question.
Okay, then I misunderstood.
It's the opposite of my question. My question is the more fundamental legal question, do we look at diminution of the estate based on whether the estate has more money than it otherwise would have had? It clearly did have $18,000 in this scenario within the one-year preference period that it otherwise would have. Or do we look at what the BAP looked at? You look at diminution of the estate, not in terms of whether or not the estate had more money, but looking at whether or not the replacement of subordinated debt with unsubordinated debt is now going to hurt other creditors. And that's an esoteric question. It's a mathematical question. Nobody's ever given us that. And I don't even understand how it could equate to the legal test in terms of the inflation of the debtor's estate based on what an individual creditor might or might not benefit or be disadvantaged by. That's my question.
Okay, I think I see now. So in terms of more money or less money, I think the first part of the problem is there's this implicit assumption, argument that the appellant is making here, that you have to consider all the other transfers that Mr. Goldstein made into the debtor.
Contemporaneous.
And, well, not just the contemporaneous ones. Their argument is you have to consider the whole $400,000.
I'm not talking about his argument. I'm talking about my
okay,
question.
Well, I'm not clear if you're asking when they're saying that does the debtor have more money, are you talking about just the transfers?
If on January 1st, if Bobby gives $18,000 within the one-year preference period and Chusa has to repay $15,000 toward the $46,000 interest payment of Paula's, they have $3,000 left. That's my hypothetical. I'll just say it's a hypothetical question.
I'm sorry. Run those numbers by me again. I got to write it down.
January 1st, $18,000 to Chusa. The condition is $15,000 has to be repaid to Paula on her $46,000 interest payment, $3,000 left to pay unsecured creditors. Is that diminution in the estate, or do you look at the more esoteric mathematical question, are individual creditors helped or hurt?
Okay, I think this case is easier than your hypothetical. Your hypothetical is a harder problem because you've clearly stated the fact is that the 18 is conditioned on the payment of the 15, so there's 3,000 extra. What we don't have, as the BAP pointed out, is actual evidence that the other payments in excess of the money used to pay Paula was actually exchanged for the payment to Paula. And so in your hypothetical, the answer would be that under 547C1, that would be a contemporaneous exchange for new value because the new value would be the additional $3,000. But what we're missing here is the evidence that this is actually an exchange.
Well, BAP actually earlier in the opinion said exactly the opposite of what it said later in the opinion when it determined that there was no exchange. They earlier said, yes, Bobby had contributed all of that money with the condition being that he would that Chusa would repay part of that toward Paula's interest in debt.
Yeah, and I acknowledge that the opinion's a little bit, opinion could be better. I'll say it that way. In general, when I look at that, I look at the underlying testimony, and I look at what Bobby actually said. You know, Bobby's whole argument about what he did, it was what is, quote, the honor of performance is a contract. That was his testimony at trial. And so his mind, the whole idea is that, well, if I did what I was supposed to do, that was the contract. And so there's nothing more beyond that. There's nothing in the record to indicate a finding that there was actually an exchange, that this payment of additional money was conditioned.
Didn't the bankruptcy court conclude that, though? Aren't we stuck with that? Subject to clear error review of what the bankruptcy court.
I think it is subject to the clear error review. I think that's right on that finding. I think that's right, and I do think it was clear error, and that's what we've been arguing all along.
Well, is that what the BAP concluded?
I think the BAP did, yes, by saying the bankruptcy court erred in concluding there was an exchange and reversing on both counts. I think the BAP did conclude that there was clear error; otherwise, they couldn't have done that. I mean, I think it's. But again, as Judge Bachrach said, the opinion is a little bit messy. Any further questions?
Well, I guess, you know, come Judge Bacharach calls it this esoteric question. On the facts here, is the BAP correct or incorrect that existing unsecured creditors were diluted?
It's 100% correct.
Claim on the state.
It's 100% correct. And what we look at is how these creditors would be treated in Chapter 7. Earlier I said, yeah, they're not a classified claim, but instead in a Chapter 7, both the pre-petition vendors, those what we're calling the Class 6 creditors in the Chapter 11, they're going to be treated in the Chapter 7 as general unsecured creditors. They're not entitled to priority, they're not subordinated, just general unsecured creditors. That's the same priority under the bankruptcy code that this new money from BGPI and Bobby will be treated as. And so even though they're not classified, they're going to be treated the same way in the Chapter 7. And so it had the effect, as the BAP pointed out, of elevating the subordinated debt under a plan to the same level as the unsubordinated debt, forming an end run around the entire terms of the bankruptcy plan. And so, Your Honors, by doing what the appellant wants you to do and by saying, well, that's okay, fine, whatever, what you're doing is allowing an end run around a Chapter 11 plan and saying, hey, wait a minute, those terms don't really matter. And holding like that, you know, I think you have to think about that in the context of the bankruptcy system as well, because it would allow anyone in any case where there is a guarantor to say, well, yeah, this subordinated debt, the guarantor is just going to loan it and we're going to pay it and that bankruptcy plan doesn't matter. We're going to elevate that debt right away through a guarantor. And I think that goes against the whole entire purpose of what a Chapter 11 plan is to do, which is to set forth how creditors are supposed to be paid.
Did CHUSA have dominion or control over the earmarked funds?
I think so. I really do. I think, you know, the case law doesn't say this, Your Honor, but in my mind, I conceptualize if you have money in your bank account, I think it ought to be treated as a rebuttable presumption that you have dominion or control over that money, up to the other side to prove that you don't. And the fact is they had the right to return.
They rebutted the presumption through the testimony in front of the bankruptcy court.
Again, I think that's the fact dispute. I think that the bankruptcy court committed clear error when it found that they did. I think the only testimony was that there was intent. I think New Mexico case law requires for there to be an agreement more than just intent in one person's head at one moment in time.
So Bobby had to sign an agreement with Bobby?
Yeah, I think that's what he did. And we actually do that. It sounds funny, but we actually do that all the time in the financial world. So when we're talking about like shareholder loans to a company, and if you don't want that loan to be treated as a capital contribution, the advice that your attorney is going to give you is to sign a promissory note with yourself as maker and yourself as borrower.
But New Mexico allows implied in fact contracts like this.
I think it does. And so I'm not disputing that this type of contract is completely disallowed or something like that. What I am disputing is that there isn't enough here to establish the terms that would be required under New Mexico law.
As you wind down here with your time, can you comment on our appellate jurisdiction?
Yes.
I don't know that we've heard from you on that.
I mean, I certainly think you do. I think you have appellate jurisdiction. I think, you know, you review the underlying case. I think the BAP opinion is persuasive only. I agree with Mr. Jaffa and all of the things he said about the standard of review. Was there a more specific question you wanted to ask?
What's your response to my question about if CHUSA had not paid the earmarked funds to Paula, could she sue for them, and what would happen to that lawsuit in the Chapter 11 or Chapter 7 scenario?
My time just ended. May I answer? Mm-hmm. All right. So what Paula Goldstein can do in a Chapter 7 case is she could file a proof of claim. That proof of claim would be for her rights for the breach of the Chapter 11 plan. And her rights under that plan were her rights as a Class 7 creditor to get paid if and only if all the creditors ahead of her in line were paid. And so the right that she would have, absent any payments, you know, through Bobby, to, you know, through what we're talking about here, would just be her same rights as a Class 7 creditor. Now, that's it. And so that claim would not have to be paid a dollar until all the Class 6 vendors were paid in full. That's the entire problem the BAP has pointed out.
Okay. All right, counsel, thank you. Appreciate the arguments.
Thank you all.
You were three over, so no additional rebuttal. All right, counsel, then you're excused, and the case shall be submitted.